Car hacking, battery swapping, and automotive dreams stamped in steel.
Auto Line After Hours is brought to you by Bridgestone Tires, your journey, our passion. Fiat. Hyundai. Learn more at Hyundai.com. And by Henkel. Excellence is our passion.
This is Auto Line After Hours with John McElroy, episode 296 for July 24th of 2015. How Tesla and CARB got us to drink the Kool-Aid. Watch Autoline After Hours live at Autoline.tv every Thursday at 3 p.m. Eastern Time. That's 12 p.m. Pacific or 19 hours GMT. You can subscribe to this podcast for free by searching for Autoline in iTunes, Stitcher, or YouTube. Gary, we're here to do yet another show.
Yet another.
We're getting close to show 300 here. We're going to have to make a big deal when we hit the 300 mark.
Sparklers and
party
horns, hats, yeah.
Right. That sort of stuff. So
I'm just back from L.A., drove the Mazda CX-3 and the MX-5, the Miata.
I've been in the Miata, not the CX-3. I'm dying to get in that
Man,
car. Really that good?
Those guys are punching way above their weight. I'm sure that they just sit and shake their heads and wonder why the heck they're not more successful.
I mean, yeah.
2% market share and phenomenal cars.
Yeah.
But then I was saying, where would you buy a Mazda around here? Do you know?
I know of one dealership. Yes, yeah. I do.
See, I was thinking about it. It's like, I have no idea where I could buy a Mazda.
Well, let's talk more about those cars later in the show, because we got to let everybody know we got Ed Niedermeyer here from the Daily Kanban. Yep. Ed, great having you on After Hours.
It's wonderful to be here. I've been watching since I started blogging, and it's just a great show. Really.
So what's the Daily Kanban, for those who are not familiar?
So the Daily Kanban is just it's a blog that Bertel Schmidt, also formerly of The Truth About Cars, and I have just started together. It's just a little ad-free blog where we write about the things that interest us about the auto industry.
Cool. Good deal.
Yeah.
And then we got to let everybody know our special guest for this show is Larry Moss, the chairman of the Concours d'Elegance of America in St. John's. In Plymouth, Michigan. Larry, great having you here.
John, it's a pleasure to be here. Thank you very much for having me.
So this is your big event. This weekend is, you got a lot going on.
Oh, yeah. This is it. This is the greatest weekend for car guys in the state of Michigan.
Well, even more, because you bring in people from all around the country, right?
31 states. 300 cars from 31 states.
That's a lot.
Top shows in the country. There's probably 60 different concours. We're in the top three.
So what are the top three? Probably Pebble Beach.
Pebble Beach, Amelia Island, and our show, which used to be the old Meadowbrook Concours, now right. Over at the Inn at St. John in Plymouth.
So how did you achieve that? You must have done something over the years to make this more special.
Creme de la creme. We had the best cars, and it was just, we're different than a lot of the shows in that we're just a bunch of car guys putting on a show. And that's what really made it different. We treated car guys like they wanted to be treated. And so we had, from all around the country, guys would come to our show every year. It was Mecca. It was a place to go to. And thankfully, still is.
I know a lot of car company people go to Pebble and Amelia, too. But right. Just being in Michigan with so much automotive here, I got to believe you get more industry people at the St. John Concours than the others.
Not as much as we used to, sadly. Not as much.
Why is that?
I wish I had that answer.
You mean car guys are not as interested in classic cars as we all used to be?
I don't know the answer to that. We have arguably one of the best shows in the country. We've got a diversity of cars like no other show around. But I'm always amazed when I hear people who don't know about our show or don't know about the extent and the diversity of our show. So obviously that's one of the reasons we're here.
So what are the parameters for someone to be able to show a car at the concourse, your concourse?
Well, it's selection only. It's invitation only. And it's about elegance. A Concours d'Elegance, as it was back in the day, was a show of elegance. So a car, first of all, has to be elegant. It has to be rare. It has to be collectible. It has to have been restored. And it has to have some interest in some way, shape, or form to be considered of the 300-some-odd cars that we have on the field.
Mm-hmm. You mentioned elegance, but what I've always liked about the St. John's or the Concours d'Elegance of America is, as you mentioned, the eclectic collection. I mean, yeah. one of my favorite, you guys put on, I think, maybe the best race car exhibit I've ever seen. All Indy cars.
Yep, 33.
You had them lined up in threes.
Yep.
And as you walked back in the field, as if they were on the grid,
yeah.
you know, you started out at the very beginning. You had a 1911 car there, if I remember right. And as you walked farther back in the grid, the cars became more and more modern. And what I loved about it is you could see distinctive changes when technology really changed the cars.
So true. And even every year we've tried to play off of that. So this year we have sprint car and midgets. We've got drag cars, early drag cars from the 1960s. And then really the one exhibit that we're most proud of this year that is probably the only time people will be able to see these cars east of California are Dry Lakester Bonneville race cars. Hmm. Phenomenal cars. These are the cars, the iconic cars that started the hot rod hobby when the vets came back from World War II. Belly tank cars, the cars of the 1930s that these guys raced on the dry lakes, 150, 200 miles an hour. And we've got a collection of some of the greatest ones ever seen here coming up this Sunday.
How do you go about deciding what you should have in the show? And then even more, how do you go out and get those cars?
Two big problems. Getting them is one thing. Deciding is another. I mean, we want a great show. We want 300 of the best cars and have it diversified. So it'll range from a steam car, a 1905 steam car, to cars from the 50s and 60s, to Duesenbergs, the classic cars, to muscle cars, to early 30s cars, to hot rods, to drag cars, and as I said, midgets and sprint cars and Bonneville cars, and a little bit of everything, and new cars. So not only will people see the old cars, but they'll see the new Lamborghini, the new LaFerrari, the new Porsche 918. It's as eclectic as you can get, and that was really one of the... It's tough. We were talking earlier about how do you attract younger people to our show, because oftentimes we get branded as an old car show. We're hardly that.
Well, I was wondering, you know, when John was saying the name of the show, and, you know, Concours d'Elegance, and I was thinking...
Yeah.
What the hell do the French have to do with the auto industry? I mean, why does everybody keep using that term?
Well, they don't. It's just that these types of shows started back in France, back in the day, and they were shows of elegance. And what they tried to do back then is combine both fashion, art, and the automobile. And most of the good shows this year, most of the good shows in the country continue that type of tradition. So we honor art, we honor fashion, and obviously the elegance of the automobile. Different from your car show. You can go to the Dream Cruise, and you can go to your car show on the weekend, but you're not going to see the cars that you're going to see on our field Sunday. They are the best of the best.
Yeah, and as you said, some very, very rare ones. Yeah. Okay, I get the part about the artist, you know, celebrating art, because there's always yeah. tents with artists' mm-hmm. displays, always selling some of their things, too. What about fashion? What are you doing in that regard?
We have a lot of fun with fashion because that's, in fact, what back in the day in...
And you're talking clothes fashion.
I'm talking clothes fashion, sure. But back in the day in France, people would wander around the field all dressed up. And so what we have three times during our show from 10 o'clock to 4 o'clock are fashion segments where a fashion model is paired with a car driving up to the podium and... talking about the fashion, which is typically period dress, with the automobile. And it's just kind of a neat way to combine both fashion and the automobile.
So it almost sounds as though you might be better off if you were to call it fashion, art, and the automobile to appeal to young people who would say, elegance, you know, what the hell is elegance?
Well, I think there's probably, I think you're right. When you say, first of all, people can't pronounce Concours d'Elegance.
Yeah.
Is it d'Elegance, the elegance?
They don't want to buy tickets. They don't want to be embarrassed when they're...
Exactly. But you're probably right. A name change for all of what we do might certainly be in order.
Hmm.
Be a little more descriptive.
You should be a marketing guy, Gary.
Yeah.
Maybe you are a marketing guy.
Yeah.
Is it more difficult to pick, like, from newer cars what fits with this theme of elegance? I mean, there's a lot of talk about how design is maybe, you know, Peter DiLorenzo had a great piece just this week, I think, talking about how design is sort of reaching a little bit of a crisis. Is it more difficult to choose modern cars that fit with this theme of elegance?
It is, you know, because if you look at some of the cars that are going to be on the field Sunday, cars that were built back in the 40s, 30s, the designs were outrageous. They were beautiful. Sometimes it's hard to look at designs today in some cases and say the same thing. We were very lucky. One of our founding fathers was Dave Holes, mm-hmm. chief of design at General Motors. And as I was on the car selection committee in the early years, Dave would look at the cars that I was selecting, and he would say, yes, no, simply based on design. And so I learned from the master on what really is a good design and what isn't.
Well you brought an example here to the studio of a car that was built in the late 40s, early 50s.
Correct, 1950.
And this beautiful Nash.
Yeah.
And so tell us something about this car.
Well, it's an interesting car. If you look at the designs, we were talking about how do you stamp the hood or the rear panels, the big cars.
Gigantic stamping.
Gigantic.
Can you imagine the gauge of that steel? So, I mean, it made it all the more difficult to stamp.
Right.
But you learned the thing about our show as well, while it's a show of elegance, there's a lot of education. People learn about the history of the automobile by coming to our show. This particular car here has front seats that go flat. You make them, it's a bed. The rear windows on this thing, you can see how big the rear windows are. They roll down.
Mm-hmm.
When you open up the trunk, there's a light that comes on, and it kind of looks odd, but it was there for a purpose. And they did it because if you had to change your tire, if you had a flat tire, that light would warn oncoming vehicles.
Because the...
They're going to it right now.
So the brake lamps are on the trunk, not on the fenders. And so when you lift
the trunk lid.
So there's a little light. There's a little light right there. And it goes on, and it was to warn oncoming cars that you've got your trunk up and you're changing the tire.
And I can't imagine changing a tire on that thing. Can you imagine trying to get it up?
Right. Well, it takes three people to do it, but you could do it.
What I like about this car is I look at it and I love the lines. Big, long, unbroken lines, this fastback that you've got to it. I love how the rear wheels are kind of fender skirted, and so are the front. Very unusual. Yep. They have the front ones. And yet you're telling me this was kind of a plain Jane car, you know, low
back
end of the market when it came out.
Back in the day.
And it's a unibody, not body on frame.
Yeah.
Oh, is that right? I didn't know that.
I didn't know that either.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah. So. But styling-wise, when you look at the cars that we'll have on the field, when you look at some, and we talk again about the French, the Delahaye,
mm-hmm.
the Hispano, the Talbot. I mean, some of these designs in a Frenet body Bentley that we're going to have on the field, that when you see how those fenders flow, if you've seen a Delahaye before and how the design
the works
of that
of art.
Fagoni Filashi designs, they are absolute works of art today.
Mm-hmm.
But they were works of art in their day, too. And they were enormously expensive cars in the day. Whereas this Nash, anybody could buy, right?
That's right. Low end of the totem pole. But what a car, though.
But what is it then, Larry, that, you know, you take a plain Jane car of 1950, and now it's worthy of being in a Concours d'Elegance? Why? What is it that's changed?
The rareness of it, the collectability aspect of it, the design. Sometimes designs don't get appreciated maybe early on, but as time goes, you look at it and it starts to wear, and you say, you know, they did it right back then. They had that was an interesting design.
So have you seen, okay, so if you're looking at some designs now and you become more appreciative of it and saying, wow, this really is well done. Have you ever had a case where you've looked at something and it's had the opposite effect, that you've said, gee, this really doesn't look as special as it once looked to me?
Or that it never looked. I mean, there was a car called a Daimler SP250 that maybe in the day had some appeal, but we look at it today and say, no, it's an interesting car, but a designer would look at it and say, it's all wrong. The layman like us might say, I like it, but design-wise, never cut the mustard.
So is there an educational component to this? Because, you know, sometimes it's really hard to appreciate. If you just look at the car, you know, you can appreciate it on a certain level, but you don't necessarily understand that, you know, these lights were sort of this innovative new design at the time, you know, or the aerodynamics or whatever it is. You know, if you look at it, it can be hard to know if you don't already have that historical knowledge. So do you guys incorporate an educational component to the show as well?
In terms of seminars, we do design seminars. So that's something we'll have this Saturday. In fact, Hagerty Insurance sponsors a design seminar for us. And Saturday, it's free. People can come and learn about design and learn about collectability. Keith Martin, who hosts a show called What's My Car Worth, is going to be there. And we try to educate, but you also get educated simply by looking at a car. When you look at a Duesenberg, you get educated. When you see the new Ferrari, the LaFerrari, and I think that's, what, $1.5 million car?
Mm-hmm.
You don't have to be a car nut to look at that and say, that is special. The new Lamborghini, the new Porsche. Something's right with those cars. And they're all going to be on the field Sunday.
So you're talking about these seminars. Now, this is just for regular folks who might be attending versus aspiring designers? Or, you know, I mean, who do you want to attract with the seminars?
Regular folks to learn about the automobile. That's one of our missions in our Concours of America, is to teach. And by putting cars, 300 cars on the field, each one has a storyboard explaining the car, the history of the car, the uniqueness of the car. The seminars that we do on Saturday, typically we do two or three seminars, design seminars. This, we're going to do one on collectability, the changing world of collectability of automobiles. Another one on the drag racing cars of the 60s. Remember, it was race on Sunday, sell on Monday.
Mm-hmm.
So we're going to have a seminar on that as well. So it's while we show cars and we do fashion and we do automobile and we do art, one of the real missions of our show is to teach.
Mm-hmm. In fact, I went to one of those seminars last year, and it was terrific. And it was all a discussion on restoration or preservation,
i.e.,
should you rip this thing down to the chassis and rebuild it from the ground up, or should you preserve that patina of history that it's got and merely get it running in good shape?
Yeah.
So my question is, where do you come down on that argument?
Oh, boy. That is often debated. If I were a restorer, obviously I'd say you should restore it.
Yeah.
But I'm a purist. So I think if you find a car that was as is, there's something to be said for an original car that hasn't been restored, that was maybe old and maybe has the patina, but it's as it was. Difficult to find, but boy, when you buy a car like that, in the hobby, most everybody will say, please don't restore it.
Mm-hmm. So in other words, something gets pulled out of a barn, and it's rusted, and the tires are crumbly, and you would say just leave it like that?
Yeah, I think to some degree, depending on the car.
Well, it depends how much rust.
What?
I mean, if it's a pile of rust.
No.
I mean, no, you got to restore it.
You know, it's a car, but I mean, it's just not like that car. I mean, that car is beautiful. I mean,
that's a ground-up restoration.
Sure.
This Nash in the studio is, right?
If you find a Ferrari in a barn or a Bugatti in a barn, and it's reasonable that you could at least tow it somewhere, well, you almost want to keep it in that condition. Now, there'll be many that will restore it. But to buy that car in original condition is going to cost you a lot of money. Restoring it's going to cost you a lot more money, and whether you'll get all that money out, maybe it doesn't matter. But there is that constant debate about restore it or keep it.
Well, in the seminar that I attended last year, is that the feeling was, you know, based on the discussion, if it's a pile of rust, but it's a valuable car, by all means, restore it. Yeah. But if it's runnable, if it's got rust, but it's mainly surface rust, if it just looks old, maybe even a bit ratty, just get the thing running and don't touch it, because there's not another one like it. You know, there's a lot of classic cars that have been completely restored, and maybe the paint job's different and the like, but they're the same. Whereas an original is just that. It's an original.
Original ones. We give an award away Sunday called The Most Original, The Way It Was. And so we promote that. We want, if there's a car out there that we think is unique and it's an original car and it has all the other attributes that we talk about that's fitting for our show, we encourage that car to come out.
So do you remember which one won last year?
Wasn't that Doctor's World War I? Or is that 2 years ago? There was some, medical staff car that you guys...
That's correct. It was a 1918 Cadillac.
Mm-hmm.
And that won the FIVA Award for most original. It was an original car from 1918, was used in the war. Pretty phenomenal.
Mm-hmm.
Now, do you restore that car?
Hell no.
I don't think so. I don't think that car will ever be restored.
But it was in pretty good
shape. Nor should it.
And it was in pretty good shape.
Reasonably good shape.
Oh.
Yeah, but that car should never be restored.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Now, if you found this car in a barn, of 1950 Nash, in a barn, and all original, there's no purpose to keeping it all original. With all due respect, you restore it.
Why is that?
Collectability-wise. An original 1950 Nash has no interest. It's historically not a significant car, again, with all due respect. But if it were a Ferrari GTO that were found, you want to leave that in original condition. Because that is unique, that is collectible, that kind of car shouldn't be restored. All those types of cars we'll have on our field Sunday.
You know, you see that all the time. If you ever watch Antiques Roadshow on PBS, somebody brings in this beautiful piece of furniture and they go, boy, it's probably worth about $3,000. If you hadn't restored it, it might be worth $30,000.
Yeah,
so there's that going on, too. Hey, look, we're going to take a quick break here, but we got a lot more to talk about of the Concours d'Elegance of America. Okay, we're back talking with Larry Moss all about the Concours d'Elegance. Hey, another category that you guys have listed for this year's show is what you're calling pickups of the jet age. Tell us about that.
Well, that was actually last year.
Oh, that was last year?
Yeah.
Oh, maybe I was looking at last year's website.
But that shows you, too, the diversity of our show.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, pickups. This year we're doing the Auto Show 1955, celebrating cars that were produced during 1955 from all the automobile manufacturers. But we are the first and only Concours that ever featured pickup trucks. Mm-hmm. We'll have a few on the field this coming Sunday, but that's the uniqueness of what we do. There is something on the field for everybody. If you're a car nut, you'll find something that you like.
But you still have the what you'd expect at a Concours, the brass cars, the Depression-era
exactly.
coach-built cars and the like.
Yes. Brass cars, muscle cars, sports cars, classic cars, 50s cars, 60s cars, vintage Bentleys. How about hearses? Vintage hearses we're going to have.
That's the one I want to. I would have loved to have been in on the discussion of that. Where did you guys ever come up with that idea?
Well, I was on the other end of that discussion.
I'll bet you were.
I was not. I'm a traditionalist. And I didn't think that would be appropriate for a major Concours until I was shown pictures of these vintage hearses from the 20s and 30s at how ornate these were. It isn't what we think of as a hearse. And so that is somewhat consistent with what we're trying to do, showcase beauty and elegance. Not that what was in it or what it was used for is
might be slightly
that
macabre, but it's still beautiful. You know,
but they were very, very ornate and beautiful cars. So that's one of our features this year.
Mm-hmm.
The Bonneville cars are another feature of ours this year. And we've got our enthusiast of the year, Bruce Meyer, coming from California, with probably, if all you saw of the 300 cars were the cars that Bruce is bringing, you'd be done.
Well,
you'd be a happy camper.
And Bonneville is not happening this year, I understand. The salt is not firm enough for Bonneville to happen, so you may see a big influx of people who otherwise would not have been able to see them this year.
We've got the greatest collection of Bonneville cars ever seen east of California. And as I said earlier, these are the iconic cars that started the hot rod age.
All right.
And to have those on the field with vintage hearses, with vintage Bentleys, with sports cars, muscle cars, brass cars, 1955 cars, new cars, old cars, I don't know what else you can do.
I love those belly tank cars, some of my all-time favorite ones. Those things are awesome.
The Tom Beatty Lakester coming out of the Henry Ford Museum is going to be at our show. A P-51 Mustang, you know, those fuel tanks were very aerodynamic. And these guys back in the late 40s, early 50s thought, you know, maybe we could use those. They were light. They were made out of aluminum. Make them into a race car. Put an engine in there and see what happens.
Mm-hmm.
And they did.
And
the rest is history.
Ran at some pretty good speeds, too.
The Tom Beatty car, in the end, ran well over 200 miles an hour. Now, I wouldn't want to be in it driving that, but.
That's great. Hey, we got some questions that have come in here. Guy named Where Are My Glasses? Wants to know, classic cars belong in museums. They're great to own in their own respect, but I want the best and greatest. Why should I go to a Concours?
Well, if all you're going to see is classic cars, and if that's not his cup of tea, then that's a good question. But we've got 300 cars in the field. The other 270 cars are going to be 50s, 60s, 70s, new cars, old cars, muscle cars, sports cars. He can toss the classics aside, though he shouldn't. because that was the grand period of design and technology. But he's going to have a whole lot of other cars to choose from.
The other thing I would add is oftentimes when you go to a Concours, like the Concours d'Elegance, typically the owners are there.
Yeah.
And you can get to talk to them, and you'll learn more about that car than you'll ever learn in a museum.
Exactly. Yep.
Okay, Ray wants to know, is there any car you want at your show but have not been able to get?
Oh, yes. Oh, yes.
Like what?
Oh, we're doing early Japanese sports cars and the Toyota 2000 GT. Difficult car. It's a car that years ago nobody really cared about. Today they're million-dollar cars.
Right. Mazda Cosmo.
Exactly, exactly. A Ferrari GTO. I mean, those cars, there aren't a lot of them, and they're worth megabucks. We've got one car in our field. I won't say which one it is, but it's got a price tag of over $10 million.
$10 million?
$10 million. Yeah.
And you won't say for
that,
insurance
that one
reasons?
We have. Yeah.
Yeah.
But that one we got. But there's a lot of cars out there. You always have a wish list of cars that you would love to have at the show. And sometimes tough to get, but it's on your wish list, and you keep working at it.
So if someone went last year and they come this year, will they see all new cars, or will there be a percentage of cars that were at the event last year?
The intent is to change the field every year, so that if you went last year and you come this year, if you were amazed last year, you will be even more amazed this year, because you won't see the same cars.
Mm-hmm.
You'll see different cars, different features. And we try to keep every year a little bit different.
Mm-hmm.
Hey, I got the sign from the control room. We've got a phone call. Let's bring it in.
Yes, John from Cleveland, Ohio. If you show that car at the car show, I think you ought to have Clark Kent and Lois Lane there to represent the world's ugliest car. Thank you.
Well, it's
beauty's in the eye of the beholder.
Well, it is interesting. That question is interesting because a couple years ago, we brought in from California Nash Healey. I think it was a 1953 Nash Healey that Clark Kent drove in the TV program. I would have loved to have had Clark Kent there as well with that car, but we did have the Nash Healey from the Superman TV program.
Okay, Classic Car Guy wants to know, do Concours events make money? How do they stay in business each year?
We all ask ourselves that same question. Not so much how, but why. Why do we keep doing it? It's a difficult business, and it is a business. It is a business to one degree, but to the other, it's a charity. And we ultimately try to give money away. So if we make money, we don't keep it. We want to distribute it. We get sponsorships. We have the gate. And we have donations. And those are the three ways that we get revenue.
Are you a 501c3?
We're a 501c3.
Okay, so you're not for profit.
That's correct. Our Saturday Night Gala this year is going to give its proceeds and celebrate juvenile diabetes. Our lunch Saturday is for Forgotten Harvest. The education that we do with the seminars, we give money away if there is money after all bills are paid. So that's our mission. It's not just to put on a great car show. A bunch of car guys put in a car show, but also to do some good for the community.
That's awesome. That's terrific to hear that so many different groups are benefiting from this.
Yep.
Real good. Well, I think we're going to have to wrap this segment up right now. But Larry Moss, thanks so much for coming in and talking all about the Concours. Great to have a Nash in the studio with us to help illustrate what it's all about. And I'll be out there Sunday. I'm looking forward to it. I got to tell you quick before we just end this segment, but that Soviet-era Tupolev,
yes.
What I'm calling the Siberian ice skimmer, yeah. That thing that blew my mind. And that's what I like about St. John's. Vehicles like you never even knew existed.
People walk onto the field, and what we love about it is they look and they say, I can't believe I'm looking at that. I can't believe you've got that at the show. It's that wow factor when they walk and they look at something that they never thought they would see.
So
there'll be 300 of those cars out there Sunday.
And how can people get tickets?
Tickets are available online right now at our website, which is www.concoursusa.org, or at the gate. There's tickets available as well.
Larry Moss, thanks so much again.
Thanks for having me.
We'll be back in just a moment.
We could tell you about the years of research and development, how we forged advanced high-strength steel to make the frame stronger yet lighter. The countless hours spent testing the suspension and tuning every sound from the engine to the trunk. But until you get behind the wheel, you have no idea. The completely redesigned Hyundai Sonata.
A little chemistry goes a long way, especially when it comes to vehicle development. From enabling the use of alternate materials to withstanding extreme vehicle environments, Henkel's adhesive, sealants, and surface technologies provide solutions for every vehicle segment. Come see for yourself. Our Detroit area headquarters offers 12 research and development and testing laboratories with the ability to do full-range testing and validation on actual vehicle parts. Sign up to tour our labs at henkelna.com/tour.
It's going to be real interesting. It's quite a display. I'm bothered by what he said, though, that people in the auto industry are not turning out for something like this like they used to in the past. That bugs me. Because when I go, I mean, I run into a lot of people, especially in the design community. All the top design people will be out there. So.
Well, this year they're up against the Maker Faire, so which I'll be at.
Yeah, that's a fun event, too.
It is. It's great.
So, Ed, I'm so glad that you're in the studio talking about the show here, because I'm dying to hear about an update on that story that you broke about Tesla's battery swap, where they're getting all this money from the state of California for ostensibly offering these battery swaps for Tesla Model S's. And you were pretty much able to document this really isn't happening much at all, if at all.
Yeah. It's not. Unfortunately, I haven't been able to invest a ton of time, but I was able to talk with someone with CARB and
California Air Resources.
Yeah. Uh-huh. And then also the National Resource Defense Council, which has been part of the whole regulatory process and sort of developing this policy. And so it was interesting talking to CARB because, you know, there's so much evidence. And of course,
well, explain what this whole scheme is.
Yeah. So there, you know, there's this, it's a zero emission vehicle credit program in California. And automakers get credits for building a certain number, like more than a certain percentage of their vehicles sold are zero emission, then they get credits. And if they're below that, then they have to buy credits. And then there's extra credits and like up to not quite double, but nearly double the credits. And it changes year to year. So there's tons of complexity in this. For a fast refueling capability, and initially that was just a capability. A company would just have to prove to CARB that they could do this, and then they would get almost double as many credits. And when these credits, you know, trade at up to the fine per credit is $5,000, so the market value is up to $5,000, and you start adding this up, and it's a lot of money, and especially for a company like Tesla that's never been GAAP profitable, you know, that kind of revenue stream is really, really important. And what's interesting is that Tesla is the only company that's been doing this fast refueling thing for battery electric vehicles. Of course, for hydrogen electric, it's not hard. So to back up the fast refueling thing, you have to be able to get 80% of your range, give or take, 85% of your range, give or take, in under 15 minutes. And with a battery, you can't do that by just plugging it in. And so swapping the battery out is the only way to do it. And you know, there's this divide between battery electric fans and hydrogen fans. And, you know, the hydrogen cars have no problem with this. And, you know, CARB's position on that is that, you know, well, we want to try and make, you know, it's technology neutral. But it's really, you know, some technologies have advantages that others don't. And if you want to get people to use zero emission vehicles and you want to encourage ones that give a really similar user experience to gasoline cars, because that's what people are used to, you know, hydrogen just has that advantage. It's just.
Because you can fill up the tank with a liquid hydrogen.
Exactly. It just takes minutes.
We've got a graphic about hydrogen shortly,
Good.
Wait for that. So anyway, back to your story. So basically, Tesla built this facility, which they claimed that you could drive your Model S into,
yep,
and magically the battery would come out and a new battery would come in, and
yep,
it would take, it'd be like Jiffy Lube.
Yeah, exactly. And they did this big demonstration. I mean, so first of all, they did a secret demonstration for CARB, which is how they were able to start earning credits in the first place. We still don't know exactly how many credits they are. And that's one of the big problems that I found with this whole system is that there's very little transparency. And that's a big problem because how do you tell if this policy is working or not really? And so they had the secret demonstration. Then they had this big public demonstration where everything was kind of behind these curtains. And, you know, Musk claimed that it was all automated. But there was no proof that it was actually automated. And now it turns out, you know, the story has been coming out little bit by bit. And so you know, I'd heard about this. I was really interested in Project Better Place, which was the big attempt at battery swap. I thought it was a fascinating concept and one of the real opportunities to make EVs viable. And that failed. And
Shai Agassi was like the Elon Musk of battery changes.
Swapping.
Oh, my God. He would mesmerize you with the wisdom of swapping out
and
batteries.
And I'll admit, I was taken in a little by Shai Agassi. And I see now a just sort of disturbing trend where this concept is kind of turning out to be a little bit of a snake oil situation in the sense that, you know, you get these really, you know, dynamic guys saying this is going to be the future, and yet it just never happens. And so I, you know, I spent a lot of time online doing research, and I just could not find a single account anywhere of anyone actually swapping this battery. So I thought this is nuts. And it kind of all came together right before Memorial Day weekend, and AAA came out and said this is going to be the biggest traffic day of the, you know, weekend of the year. I thought, well, I'll go down. And believe me, I did not want to spend 4 days at a truck stop next to a cow ranch in the middle of California Central Valley, but I did. And, you know, and of course, you know, it's like I say, you know, you can't prove that Bigfoot doesn't exist, right? You can spend all the time you want in the woods. You can't prove a negative.
Loch Ness Monster.
Yeah, exactly. But the point is that I did not see a single battery swap happen there. But what I did see is I saw, you know, Teslas backed up into the parking lot because there weren't enough chargers, even though they had...
This is a supercharger station that had this capability, and this is the one and only...
Swap station. So they're actually, it's in slightly, the supercharger station sort of over here, and then like right nearby is the swap station. And what they'd actually done, so I thought, you know, clearly they anticipated high traffic demand, right? Because instead of making this battery swap capability open to the public, which they said they already had at that point, instead they had two extra supercharger stations behind the swap station powered by a diesel generator, which I thought was interesting, given, you know, that Tesla is considered a green car company.
Should have used methane from those cows.
Yeah. Right?
That would have been cleaner.
Yeah. And so I didn't see a single swap happen, you know, and I talked to Tesla about it, and they didn't really give me anything. They couldn't explain what was going on. I mean, they basically said it's a, you know, limited thing, but at the same time, it's open to anyone. And then, you know, the week after that story came out, all of a sudden, people started posting, hey, I got an invite from Tesla to join the battery swap program. And, you know, I'm not going to say it was because of my story. It could just be coincidence, but...
No, it's not coincidence. But I thought Elon Musk shortly after said that they really weren't going to pursue battery swapping. And I thought CARB came out and said, we're going to phase this out.
Yeah, so that's what's really interesting is that, and he actually had said that before the swap came out. I mean, there's been this whole weird thing where he's actually, what he said after the story came out was that we never thought this was going to be a real thing. So it's like, so why did you invest in it? And especially when you look at what happened with Better Place, they said the big challenge is getting the car makers to undergo all of the engineering. I mean, you guys know engineering a car is all about compromises, and putting in a swap capability creates huge compromises in all these other areas. And so it was really weird that why would they engineer that capability in from the first place, knowing that we don't really think that consumers are going to use it. It just didn't add up. And what's actually turned out, one of the really interesting things is that the Signature Series of the Tesla Model S, which were the first ones coming out, they can't swap at all. Tesla very quietly released, well, actually, I don't think they even released it. It's just been talked about on the forums now. Someone asked, and they said, no, we can't even do that. So they've actually had to modify the cars, even though they said from the get-go, we've engineered this capability in, they actually have had to do a bunch of modifications to be able to do any kind of swaps. And some of those Model S's, they can't even modify to swap.
So I mean, is the big problem here that Tesla is getting credits for every Model S it produces because of this potential capability?
They're getting more credits than everyone else, right? Anybody who sells an EV or sells the right percentage of EVs or zero-emission vehicles in California gets credits. And that's just, you know, it would be a level playing field. But this swap capability credit, fast refueling credit, only Tesla, and that's what I think is kind of fascinating last time we spoke, is that, you know, why aren't more people taking advantage of it? And the more I've looked into it, the more I've realized the relationship between Tesla and CARB is very symbiotic and very close. I, you know, obviously all those conversations happen behind closed doors, but and CARB. So I went to CARB and I asked them after I ran the story and I did the analysis. I went to CARB and I said, look, guys, you know, it doesn't look like your policy is working. And they said, well, yeah, actually, like a year before or something, CARB staff, not the board members, but the staff said, let's just kill this credit. It's not going anywhere. Let's kill it. And the board said, no, we'll modify it. And you know, it's hard to get too in the weeds on the policy stuff. But they basically, instead of saying you get double the credits for swapping on every single vehicle, you could swap a vehicle up to 25 times. And so that you could do a small percentage of a fleet, and then the whole fleet would actually get those extra credits. And CARB would not admit to me that the policy is a failure, but they at the same time said, staff recommended that we kill it, we're modifying it, but we're not happy with that modification, and it's going to be modified again, and then in 2018 it's all just going away. And I don't think it's a coincidence that it's going away right at the time when Tesla's Model 3 comes out. To me, this seems like a stealth subsidy that's helping Tesla bridge the gap between Model S and Model 3.
I've heard some estimates that the state of California may have poured as much as $200 million into Tesla with this battery swapping scheme.
Yeah, I mean, the numbers are hard to calculate because it's not public.
Right.
Yeah.
So it could be very little, could be over $200 million.
Yep.
But
yeah, and we'll get the first data for the amount of cars that Tesla swapped in 2016.
Okay, back in a minute.
Amore.
Subito.
The all-new Fiat 500 X crossover, featuring an available Uconnect system with a 6.5-inch touchscreen and available all-wheel drive. Well-rounded, has never looked so sharp.
Okay, we're back, and the control room has just told me we got another phone call coming in that had nothing to do with anything that we're talking about, but let's bring it in anyway.
John Paul from out in Idaho. Used to live and work in the auto industry for about 20 years, watching your PPDs for many years. Can you tell me, what do you think the fate's going to be of the Fiat plant, the Chrysler plant in Belvedere? The cars have only been selling 70,000 a year. Folks moving out of Mexico. Would they be able to save the plant? It really doesn't look good. And I like the car a lot. It's just not selling. Take care. Great show. Bye.
Yeah. Hey, thanks for the call. What do they make there, Gary? The Dart?
Dart?
Yeah. Don't they make like the...
don't make the Caliber anymore.
Not the Caliber. No, that died. No, they've got... Don't they have like the Jeep Patriot and...
Is it Patriot and Liberty?
And Liberty, I think, are in that plant.
Yeah.
Look, the Dart is a dodo. It's dead on arrival.
Liberty's done.
So it's still the Compass is there?
Is it Compass?
I think it's Compass.
27,000 so far this year of that.
But the point is they were counting on the Dart to really do it. They launched the car when it was severely underpowered.
49,000 darts.
Killed it. I mean, you blow a launch, you never get a second chance.
Mm-hmm. And what's interesting about that is that, you know, that 1.4T engine, that was part of you know, Fiat got 5% of Chrysler's equity for you know, putting that engine. And for having the aero version of the Dart was another 5%.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And so, you know, I know I'm pretty famous for harping on about the bailout, but, you know, we see these sort of negative effects drift in and, you know.
To me, though, the problem with the Dart is it's the wrong car for Dodge. Dodge needs a hot hatchback. What they got to do is rip that body off, slap a hatch on it, you know, goose it with some more power, and now you'll have something that at least belongs in the Dodge showroom. Whether that'll work or not, I don't know. But for sure, the Dart as it exists is not working.
I mean, and it seems to me that over the years that Chrysler invested a lot of money in Belvedere. And because remember the, what was the PT Cruiser problem when the paint shop wasn't high enough? And they learned from that mistake, and I think they put a lot of dough in that place. And so it would surprise me if you took a small car facility out of, you know, offline. And so But whether it go all to Mexico or not, who knows?
I think they need that plant, at least right now. I don't think Belvedere is going away, not in the near term. Mm-hmm.
And one of the things that's interesting, if you look at Fiat's five-year, Fiat Chrysler's five-year plan, their current one, they're making up for their, you know, of course, projected sales increases. It's not really coming from expanding capacity here in the U.S. It's actually importing mostly from Italy, where they made a real decision to put a lot of their, of course, a lot of that is, you know, Jeep Renegade, you know, Alphas, Maseratis, those sorts of things. But again, you know, you look at sort of what we thought was going to happen out of the bailout, and we thought that was going to be about reinvigorating manufacturing base here. And it turns out with Fiat Chrysler that actually their imports are going like this and their local manufacturing is going flat.
Well, yeah, on a percentage basis, but there isn't a whole lot of Alphas coming in. Maserati sales are tanking.
These are projections.
Fiat, yeah, right, right. I hear you. But Gary, you had a data point.
Yeah,
that
we were just mentioning the fast charging of hydrogen, and so this week Toyota opened up the ordering. If you live in California, for the Mirai fuel cell car, which will basically be the first hydrogen powered production vehicle that'll be out there.
There's a picture up. Boy, that thing is like it got beat with the ugly stick. In my opinion.
So it's $57,500 to get into that car.
$57,500.
And that's not including the 835 for destination. However,
why don't they put the destination in there? That should be illegal.
So Toyota's going to kick in $7,500 or have a sweet lease deal. So you've got that going for you, and they're offering 3 years of fuel.
Free hydrogen
for 3 years or $15,000, whichever comes first. I have a feeling the
$15,000 in fuel for 3 years?
Whatever comes first. So they're covering this.
How expensive is hydrogen?
Well, so hydrogen is basically
going to... I mean, in a gasoline car, you're going to spend $4,000?
Yeah, so they're covering themselves because hydrogen is going to be from $2 to $4 per kilogram, which is the way it works out. So that's like $2 to $4 a gallon. So it'll all work out. So the range of the car though is 312 miles, which beats Elon's 289
something like that.
Yeah. So they're saying that so this is zero emission
vehicle.
That's
right now. Elon will have it over 312 in a couple of years.
Okay, but refueling, 5 minutes, right? So
you can find a refueling station.
So here's the thing. So there are eight dealers in all of California that will have that car. 4 in Southern California, 4 in Northern California.
Yeah, let's boil it down to San Francisco and L.A. That's where it's going to be.
And there are in California right now how many hydrogen refueling stations?
10?
2 to 4?
8.
Oh.
A total of 8. So think about this. So you're having a new car.
It's okay. They're only going to sell 8 of them. You got a whole station for yourself.
So will they get big credits for this?
Yeah. They will get credits.
7 credits, right?
Yeah. And it depends on how many people take. And I'm not sure if there's a lease deal. My understanding is.
Yeah, there is a lease deal. It's $4.99 a month. For 36 months.
Which then, you think about that and free fuel, and, then it starts to become something that maybe
makes
a certain amount of sense.
Look, these people are going to flock just so they can be telling all their friends and neighbors they got a hydrogen car. I'd do it too.
Well, and, I don't drive a lot of cars, but I have driven the Mirai, and honestly, I was pretty impressed. It feels like a little space shuttle. And I think they did a really good job. And I think what I learned from sort of going to the event, and I had no idea about this, is the extent to which they're leveraging their hybrid technology in order to. So actually, what's interesting about this is that it's actually adding scale to their already massively scaled hybrid.
Right.
System. And so that is kind of, for me, what took this whole Toyota doing hydrogen thing from like, oh, it's a science experiment and they're just, taking a shot and seeing what happens, or just doing it for carb credits. That's where it starts making sense, is that they're actually building off of their hybrid technology. And when they developed that hybrid technology, did they see this coming? Maybe they did. But it's amazing that it's been able to build on that, because I did not see that coming.
Right. I don't know. I love all the ideas about a hydrogen fuel cell. I am so skeptical of this catching on. I was very skeptical about electric cars. In 2010, I said, let's not be hasty. Let's wait until about 2015, and then we can judge whether electric cars have been a success or not. Well, here we are, and they're not a success at all, with maybe the exception of Tesla, even though it's not making any money on it yet. But hydrogen? Now where are you going to get your hydrogen? You have to manufacture hydrogen. That takes energy.
Well, someone might say that you have to dig a hole in the ground to get gasoline, and that seems silly.
But it's a one-time stunt cost.
That sort of seems silly, too.
Here's the other thing I just learned today. Hydrogen fuel cells put out a lot of water. They put out 2 gallons every hour. Now, what's going to happen?
This is why they're driving around in California, because I was just out there, and, you know, it's all brown. They need that water.
They need that water spilling onto the street.
I'm straight.
But I'm more worried about what happens in winter when you have a busy intersection with many thousands of cars going by all the time, spitting water out the tailpipe that then freezes.
Toyota
has anybody looked into this?
They're aware of that problem, but I didn't hear anything from them that said this is, you know, that it's just not going to be a problem. It's like we know that that's an issue, and right now we're just doing California, and maybe they'll have to have a tank that the water eventually goes into. I don't know.
I was stunned.
Come on. This will be the future, John, and we know in the future all roads will just be completely wired, so it'll just evaporate. It will not be a problem.
I had no idea they put out that much water.
Yeah, but over an hour, come on. You're driving your Mirai 60 miles an hour for an hour. So how much of that water is going to be collecting in any one place?
I know. Depends on how many are on the road, right?
But now let's go ahead 40 years and all vehicles are hydrogen fuel cells.
But then we'll be flying above the ground, so there won't be that problem.
Teletransporting. Yeah. There you go. Okay, problem solved.
Speaking of technology, that big issue this week with the...
The
hacking of the Cherokee.
Yeah. I think it's the biggest story of the week, maybe of the month, maybe of the year. I think that these kinds of stories, you know, BMW had that issue with in Europe where they realized their connectivity is totally unencrypted. I mean, it's one thing to have a website that doesn't have HTTPS, but when you have your car connected without HTTPS, I mean, that's crazy. And I've talked to some friends who are coders and work in high technology, and they are just saying on a really basic level, like without knowing anything about the specifics of this particular hack, that there are like architectural level issues with the way cars are being built and designed that are terrifying and that car companies need to be getting ahead of it like yesterday.
I can tell you that the car companies have been working on this frantically for years right now, but they don't want to say anything about what they're doing. And in fact, I moderated a panel on cybersecurity for cars out in San Francisco a little over a month ago. And that was one of the things that came out of the discussion. Shouldn't we be having some sort of cybersecurity rating for cars? So people know that they're getting a car that's been hardened in some way, just like you get an EPA label or, and it's a 5-star rating. And these cyber guys went, nope, you don't want to tell anybody that you're a 5-star security cyber system. That's an invite to the hackers to go right after you.
Well, and so what the computer industry, whatever the information technology industry does, is they put out bounties. They encourage white hat hackers to find these vulnerabilities so that they can fix them. And I haven't heard a single automaker do that yet. And
Tesla.
Do they have a bounty?
The Wall of Fame. And they invite, you can try to hack us. Mm. And not just the car, by the way. Hack any of our corporate computer systems. Mm. If you're able to get in and we're able to verify what you did, we'll put your name or your handle, if you don't want to go by your public name, and you can go to their website. Just type in Tesla Wall of Fame. You'll find this. And they'll mail you a cast medallion that's numbered to prove that, hey, you got the medallion. And they've been doing this for over a year. And just this year, they went, hey, we're getting way too much value out of this. We can't do this for free anymore. Now they're offering money, as little as $25 up to $10,000. And the hacker community admires them for doing this.
Yep. So speaking of not wanting a sticker, it just so happens that a bill is being put into the Senate by Markey and Blumenthal, and it is literally called the Spy Car Act of 2015. I mean, this is they're saying this is an appropriate name, and in it says after 2 years after the date which the final regulations are prescribed pursuant to section blah 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 the Spy Car Act. Cars shall display a cyber dashboard as a component of the label required to be affixed to each motor vehicle under section blah, blah, blah. The cyber dashboard required under paragraph 1 shall inform consumers through an easy-to-understand standardized graphic about the extent to which the motor vehicle protects the cybersecurity and privacy of motor vehicle owners, lessees, drivers, and passengers beyond the minimum requirements set forth in blah, 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 blah. That's part of this law. That
you know, why don't those guys write bills to prevent hackers from stealing tens of millions of citizens' information before they start worrying about what's going into cars? You know, what the cyber guys will tell you is nothing can be prevented from being hacked. The Pentagon's been hacked. President Obama's email has been hacked. Anything can get hacked. All you can do is hopefully slow them down. That's number one. Make it really difficult to do. You're not going to stop them, but maybe you make it a big hassle. Step number two is instant notification. Hey, somebody's in the system that shouldn't be here. And then how do you mitigate that? Can you corner them? Can you kill them? Can you do something that renders them inoperative?
Well, I think it kind of what this illustrates is sort of one of the fundamental issues that the industry faces in so many different ways dealing with these new technology challenges, which is that, right, it's an evolutionary industry. They tend to establish something and then build off it and build off it. So what we have now is you have an infotainment unit that's just been put on the car, right? And then that is connected to this pretty antiquated OBD system, which gives you integrated access to all of your vehicle controls. And that's not being air-gapped. And I think that, you know, rethinking entirely, right? Instead of just slapping the infotainment system on there, trying to make that secure, because like you say, you will never make that hack-proof. There's no such thing as a hack-proof connected, you know, computer. And so I think really what you have to do is you have to start going back and looking at the vehicle systems and finding, you know, because everything has been integrate, and then maybe now, you know, sort of how do we deintegrate some of these things so that if you do hack that infotainment system, you don't suddenly have, you know, access to all of the vehicle controls.
The transmission doesn't fail.
Yeah, but then now you have to start giving up capabilities in your car. Because one of the beauties of having a CAN, a controller area network, where everything's connected, is now you can start taking real-time traffic updates and updating it into, you know, what the engine or the transmission should be doing or other things like that.
But, I mean, I think this hack that these guys did on that car was basically what they did was they found that it had an IP address. Okay,
correct.
And that is not specifically related to the vehicle functionality. That is these people chasing after. Oh boy, we're going to have Wi-Fi capability, and our car is going to be a hotspot.
Well, cellular, actually.
But I mean, and so by giving it the IP address, that's how they got in. If the car was basically a car that had all of these networks integrated through the CAN bus, which would be fine, it wouldn't be broadcasting its existence to the world. Right?
That is actually exactly what one of my coder friends told me, is that the fact that these things have public IPs is just unthinkable from an information security perspective. It's right. Unthinkable. And again, what's interesting is that, you know, the information security has for computers, right, has been a thing for a long time. And people have been, you know, have bounties on 0 days. And all this stuff has been coming for a long time, and I think, you know, the car industry has as well, but I think there's still a lag. And if you know, computers can still get hacked, the government, OPM, that huge hack could happen when information security has been such a big thing there, that if the car industry is behind on it, then they're really, I mean, we're going to be hearing these stories for decades to come.
And I think the problem is that, you know, chasing after the whole notion of the Internet of Things, that everything will then have an IP address. At some point, one of those cameras will have an IP address, and they'll be doing all kinds of stuff during the show, and we'll have no control over
it. Yeah, right. No, it's, to your point, Ed, you know, the electronic systems in cars, I mean, some of them go back quite a few years right now. So, you know, to come up with a totally new electronic architecture for a car, it's not like cranking out cell phones every 6 months,
right,
a new one.
But maybe the thing is that they need to have a more measured approach to how they begin to add more stuff for the infotainment.
Yep. And this is just one problem with adding more and more infotainment stuff, right? And the distracted driving is a whole other issue. And so I think there is some question about, you know, and especially, you know, it's harder and harder with traffic and everything else to just say, you know, sell the concept of the joy of driving. And I think infotainment does take away from that. And I think, you know, again, the answer has been to these challenges is like, well, we'll just add more and we'll add more and we'll add more and we'll add more. And I think what we're starting to see is that has consequences.
Mm-hmm.
I think you'll find
Oops.
Out that that the industry is doing a lot.
Yeah.
You know, General Motors is the only company so far, car company in the world, that has announced, here is our cybersecurity for car officer. When I asked Ford, how come you guys don't have it? And they said, well, actually, we do. We just haven't said anything about it. So I don't know if they're just trying to cover their tracks.
They haven't introduced this person yet.
Yeah. But there's a lot going on behind the scenes. And again, for the reason that I said, nobody wants to talk about it because they think that's an open invitation to the hacking community to attack them. Mm-hmm.
But see, again, I think that you have to invite the right hackers to hack you.
Right.
You do. Well, in fact, this month up in Troy, Michigan, Delphi, the supplier company, in conjunction with the Battelle National Laboratory, just held a hackathon. And these things are ongoing. And but the problem is there's white hats and there's black hats. And the white hats will really help you a lot. And the black hats will try to undo everything that you've learned.
It was ever
or everything that you put in place. But that, what?
It was ever thus.
That would make a good bumper sticker. Hey, guys, we're going to have to wrap this up. But Ed, thanks so much for coming over, man.
Thanks
this
for having
awesome.
Me.
This
yeah,
really cool.
Happening. Really enjoyed it.
And Gary, we're just going to keep on doing this.
Next week.
Cool.
Okay.
I want to thank all of you for having tuned in.
AutoLine After Hours is brought to you by Bridgestone Tires. Your journey, our passion. Fiat. Hyundai. Learn more at Hyundai.com. And by Henkel. Excellence is our passion.
Visit our website, Autoline.tv, where you can watch us live. Get your daily news fix with Autoline Daily and in-depth analysis and interviews with Autoline This Week. There is all that and much more at Autoline.tv.